Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Rainey Reitman of the Bradley Manning Support Network, who summarizes the issues raised in the recent military hearing of U.S. Army Private First Class Manning, accused of leaking secret government documents to WikiLeaks. Rona Moran of the WhoProfits.org website, who talks about her project's mission to expose companies that profit from the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land. And Robert Weil, author of Red Cat, White Cat, China and the Contradictions of Market Socialism, who examines the underlying causes of growing social unrest in China. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Since large protests by thousands of citizens over alleged election fraud during Russia's December 4th parliamentary election, the Kremlin has harassed opposition figures and grassroots activists by tapping their phones and making preemptive arrests. In the most high-profile case, the Kremlin leaked private phone conversations of former Deputy Prime Minister Boris Nemtsov, now leader of the opposition party of People's Freedom. The leak was designed to embarrass Nemtsov, who is heard belittling other opposition leaders. Nemtsov told the Christian Science Monitor, "This is a provocation, not against me, but against our rally on December 24th. Vladimir Putin and acting Kremlin Chief of Staff Vladislav Surkov are terrified that the protest momentum is building." Dissident and blogger Alexei Navalny received a hero's welcome when he was released from prison 15 days after he participated in a street protest against election fraud. Navalny, who is one of the most prominent campaigners against Kremlin corruption, is now being pushed to run for president against Putin in the upcoming March 4th election. Konstantin Bakulev of the Moscow-based Institute for Social Economic Modernization observed, "Navalny has the right things going for him. People say he's a nationalist, but really he's a patriot." To preempt a pending lawsuit, the state of Arizona Department of Corrections has agreed to investigate dozens of cases of denial of health care for months at a time to prisoners. As a consequence, inmates were forced to endure life-threatening illnesses. A coalition of activists led by the California-based Prison Law Office charged that the Department of Corrections had violated state and federal law and the U.S. Constitution by systematically denying health care and mental health services to inmates. Cases cited by prisoner advocates include a diabetic inmate who waited for months for insulin and lost sight in one eye. In another case, an epileptic was denied medications for weeks and suffered from repeated seizures. According to the Arizona Republic, inmates with emphysema and end-stage renal disease report they were denied treatment and medication for extended periods of time. Arizona prison officials admit there are problems with inmate health care, but say there were no systemic abuses. Yet in 2009, the department's deputy medical director for psychiatry wrote in an email, quote, "We are out of compliance with our own policies. The lack of treatment represents an escalating danger to the community, the staff, and the inmates." 2009 is the same year Arizona's Republican-led state legislature required the Department of Corrections to privatize inmate health care and reduce payments to providers to prevailing state reimbursement rates for Medicare. 2012 could be the year electric cars take off as dozens of all-electric vehicles hit showroom floors. Market analysts expect a spurt to 1.3 million plug-in auto sales a year by 2017, especially after Toyota introduces a plug-in model of its popular Prius hybrid. John Gartner of Pike Research expects over 250,000 plug-ins sold globally in 2012. President Obama has set a goal of 1 million plug-in vehicles on American roads by 2015. The Electric Power Research Institute estimates there could be up to 12 million plug-in cars on the road by 2020, with the number surging to 65 million plug-ins by 2030. Still, that would only represent 3% of all cars on American roads. Many municipalities are backing the drive for plug-in cars by building public charging stations. Austin Energy, the Texas city's local utility, for example, has built 100 charging stations for electric and hybrid vehicles. The cost to car owners will be about $2 an hour. As a spokesperson for Austin Energy explained, these charging stations are mostly psychological support for drivers that let them know they can get a charge if they need one. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After 18 months in custody, Army Private First Class Bradley Manning made his first public appearance just before Christmas at what's known as an Article 32 pretrial hearing at Fort Meade, Maryland. The hearing is the required next step in the military's legal process before the expected court-martial of the 24-year-old Manning that will likely begin in 6 to 9 months. Private Manning stands accused by the U.S. government of being the source of 260,000 diplomatic government cables and more than 90,000 intelligence reports later distributed to the press by WikiLeaks. Manning, who has been held in solitary confinement under conditions that his attorney and supporters characterize as cruel and degrading, faces 22 charges, including aiding the enemy, which carry a possible 30 years in jail. Manning's lawyer, David Coombs, has based his defense strategy on two main points. One, the leaks did little real damage to U.S. national security. And two, the military's lax security in running Manning's intelligence unit and their failure to notice and take action to address behavior indicating Private Manning was suffering from psychological distress. Your reporter spoke with Rainey Reitman, a steering committee member of the Bradley Manning Support Network. She summarizes what took place at Manning's pretrial hearing and concerns about how the hearing was conducted and the direction of the prosecution's case.
The way the hearing sort of unfolded, the government, the prosecution, was basing its argument line basically around forensic analysis. They collected all these different computers that Bradley Manning had used at different times and then did forensic analysis on them to try and pinpoint data that indicated Manning had accessed documents that later came up on the WikiLeaks website. And the defense took a different tactic. The defense said, we are here not just to discuss what happened or how it happened, but to discuss why it happened and to talk about this larger issue of government transparency. One of the major focal points of the defense's argument is that there have been no negative repercussions to this information being published, and that what is being charged against Bradley Manning is an enormous overreaction, that he should not be facing 150 years in prison, 24-year-old guy, just trying to make this country a better place, for something that, in effect, did not have any negative impact on our soldiers overseas or on our negotiations in world spheres. So that was one of their core arguments. I believe many of the witnesses that were denied were going to speak to that particular issue.
What kind of penalty do the charges that Bradley Manning faces? What is his possible jail sentence if he is convicted for these crimes? And I know the defense is concerned that the harshness of the sentence that he may be liable to get is in part a way to pressure him to cooperate with the prosecution to pursue a prosecution against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. You want to speak to that, please?
Yes, but I think you nailed it on the head. The defense and many of the analysts who've been watching this case believe that the government is pursuing Bradley Manning in this particularly harsh manner because they're hoping to get him to testify against WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, and also to make an example of him. The charges altogether, if Manning were to be convicted of all of them and get the highest sentence, would be some 150 years in prison. The death penalty is actually still on the table. The prosecution has stated that they aren't, at this point anyway, going to pursue the death penalty, though it's certainly possible that that's something that could be faced. The defense has asked that most of these charges be dropped, especially egregious ones like aiding the enemy, and that instead they face simple overstepping classification boundaries and something more to the tune of, maximum charge, 30 years. And so what we're waiting for now is for the investigating officer to review the information that was reported to him and decide if he's going to recommend that all of those charges go to a court-martial or whether they should be reduced before the court-martial.
Rainey, I wanted to discuss with you the allegation by the defense that there is an epidemic of overclassified U.S. government documents that in some way led somebody like Bradley Manning to release them, thinking that the public has a right to know many of the things that were divulged in the documents that WikiLeaks eventually did release to the public and the press. Tell us a bit about overclassification as an issue here.
Well, this has actually become a huge issue of public controversy. As you probably know, in 2010 alone, there were 77 million documents classified by our government. That's a 40% jump over the prior year. And the number of people with security clearances is around 4.2 million. That's more people than are in the city of Los Angeles. The classification of documents has become the default in our military culture. There's this idea to constantly hide things away, but many of the things that are being so carefully classified are not only things that won't hurt or endanger our military work overseas, they also are attempts to cover up some very concerning situations that happen. So, for example, one of the leaks that has not come out yet, has yet to be published, but is attributed to Bradley Manning, is the Guarani airstrike, also known as the Granai massacre, in which there's an airstrike by U.S. military forces that killed, I think it was a total of about 120 people. I'm not sure on the total, but it was 90 school children. And this is along with the video collateral murder, which shows two Reuters journalists getting gunned down by Americans. Some of the things that Manning saw that led him to speak out and to leak documents. So there's this idea that there was no method, no mechanism in place whatsoever that someone like Bradley Manning would have had a way to get that information out other than leaking it, because there's no way to really unclassify documents for somebody like Bradley Manning, who saw something that disturbed his conscience.
That was Rainey Reitman, a steering committee member of the Bradley Manning Support Network. Learn more about the issues in the Bradley Manning case by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. From a small office on a busy street in Tel Aviv, Israel, a trio of women produced the influential website Who Profits? It's a project of the Women's Coalition for Peace that investigates companies that profit from the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, part of the Palestinian occupied territories. They research global companies involved in construction, communication, and in some cases, exploitation of Palestinian resources for export. Rona Moran, one of the Israeli women researchers, explains that the project was born out of a heated debate about whether the Women's Coalition should support the call by many Palestinian civil society groups for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, known as BDS. Researching the companies that profit was a compromise position, a way of collecting more information, but it has also become an invaluable tool for solidarity activists all over the world. In exposing companies and corporations involved in the occupation, the group hopes to promote a change in public opinion and corporate policies, leading to an end to the occupation. The fact that one of the researchers is a Palestinian-Israeli citizen means she can visit parts of the West Bank for her research that the other two women are barred from. On a recent visit to Israel on the West Bank, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Rona Moran, who talks about the effectiveness of their project in exposing companies that profit from the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land.
What we are doing, we are an information center, and for calls and for questions from all over the world of activists that are asking, what is the situation? Is this company involved in activity in the West Bank? And we can say, this is the situation right now. They withdrew from, they closed their factory, they invested in this company. And the fact that we are able to read in Hebrew and to check and monitor the activities of these companies allow us to spread this information for a very vast community of activists all over the world. Our function in this system is to provide the most accurate and updated information that we can find.
Can you tell me about any particular information that you found through your research that turned out to be really useful for folks who are interested in this issue?
For example, last week we had some French activists over here and they asked about French companies, and then I told them about the involvement of Veolia in the occupied territories. It's a huge French company that is involved in infrastructure projects, usually working on the transportation, water, and garbage disposal, things like that. And they are heavily involved in the building and operating of the light rail train in Jerusalem, which is a massive project that was built in order to connect the settlement in the east side of Jerusalem into the west side of the city. So they practically built it, and there was a very intense international campaign against it. But during the research, at the beginning, we only knew about the light rail, but as we checked all the subsidiaries of the company, we discovered that they have a landfill in the Jordan Valley, and that they transfer and they waste from inside Israel into the occupied territories to that landfill. And we discovered that they operate through their transportation unit and a subsidiary called Connex, a few bus lines that go on apartheid roads from Modi'in Ilit to Jerusalem and Beit Horon area, and Palestinians are not allowed to use this road. So the deeper you go, the more things come up. For example, the information about the landfill was received from a request for information that we filed for the civil administrations, Ministry of Security. And so we received the information, and 2 days later it was, you know, spread to... So it's important to us that we will be able to provide information, you know, on real time sometimes. Usually we work with the information that companies publish themselves on their websites, on marketing materials, in reports that they file for the state or for financial issues. Their annual reports is one of the best information sources there are. Sometimes you get all the information and you get it fast. Sometimes security issues do come up, and then we have to apply to the Supreme Court in several occasions.
We just spoke to someone who works, you know, on the BDS campaign, and he says it's been very successful. You know, in the 6 years since it started, it's really kind of taken off, and there is some awareness around the world about it. How do you view it? Do you think that it is a successful campaign, and if so, how do you judge that?
I can say it only as a fellow activist and not as a part of the project. I think that the economic pressure is heavily felt by Israeli companies and by the Israeli government, who fear this campaign greatly. And you can see it in hysterical reactions of diplomatic Israeli representatives all over the world when they have to address the issue of the boycott. I think we are only getting started. This is only the beginning. The more information that we'll have on this issue and the more successful campaigns that we will have, I believe that international companies will find it a lot more complicated to be involved in this kind of activity. I think that the most important thing that we can say about the project is that it reveals something that people usually don't understand. When you speak about economic activity in the occupied territories, people think about settlement products. Settlement products are almost insignificant. They are such a small portion of the economic activity that is going on in the West Bank that dealing with it is like, it's like peanuts. The involvement of Israeli companies in the Israeli economic system in the West Bank is massive. It's undeniable, and it involves banks and construction companies and law firms, and every part of the Israeli market is there. The fact that Israeli companies use the Palestinian market as a captive market, it's such an enormous advantage for them. So in many ways, we want to show the wider picture and to show that the involvement doesn't stop at the green line. You don't have to have a factory in a settlement in order to be involved over there. So this is the main thing.
That was Rona Moran of the research project Who Profits. To find a link to the group's website and additional information, visit our website at btlonline.org. Wukan, a southern Chinese village of between 13 and 20,000 people, has witnessed growing unrest since September, when protests erupted over charges that local Communist Party officials were profiteering from the confiscation of farmland that was to be developed into expensive villas. After several representatives of the protest movement were taken into police custody 2 weeks ago, villagers reacted by driving out local government officials and police and blocking the return with felled trees on local roads. One dissident detained died while in police custody, which protesters believed was a result of a severe beating, further increasing tensions. In recent days, however, communist authorities agreed to a compromise with protesters, giving in to their key demands to return some of the confiscated farmland and to release protesters earlier detained by police. Northeast of Wukan, the town of Haimen has been the site of protests by local citizens who oppose a planned coal-fired power plant to be built there. The situation in Guangdong province is evidence of a pattern of growing social unrest across China, where citizens are rising up to challenge official corruption and unpopular government policies on land issues, worker rights, and unregulated industrial pollution. Some observers believe that a slowdown in the Chinese economy due to a drop in exports owing to the world recession may exacerbate an already tense situation. Your reporter spoke with Robert Weil, author of the book Red Cat, White Cat, China and the Contradictions of Market Socialism, who examines the underlying causes of growing social unrest in China.
There's been growing unrest in China now for many, many years. The government keeps tally of what it refers to, in different phrases are used, but essentially significant disturbances. And other people track them as well. And these numbers have been going up year by year, and there are tens of thousands of them. The current figure, people are putting somewhere around 100 or 120,000 such incidents a year. And I actually ran it through my calculator the other day. And, I mean, this works out to something like 275 or 300 incidents across the country daily, you know, to reach that kind of annual total. These take all kinds of forms. In the cities, wildcat strikes by workers, protests about factory conditions, blocking roads sometimes, or surrounding buildings, or going to government offices. In the countryside, the issues are generally around land, and in particular, the practice of local governments of essentially seizing what is still supposed to be collectively owned land in the villages, and selling it off or leasing it off long-term to developers for high-rise apartments, golf courses, factories, whatever. Very often in a corrupt relationship between the officials and the people buying the land, keeping much of the profits for themselves or getting a share of the new project. And the villagers, in many cases, see little or nothing of the money. So they lose both their land and the value of the land. They aren't compensated for it. And that's the background for what's happening in Wukan, because this process has been going on now for about 15 years there, apparently, and has actually cost the villagers the majority of their land. And it finally just reached a breaking point with this last sale.
Robert Weil, what's the context for these thousands or tens of thousands or more of these incidents that occur where people rise up and challenge the Communist Party officials who they accuse of corruption or otherwise cheating people of their property or basic issues of civil liberties?
Well, the larger context is that, of course, under Mao Zedong, beginning really back in the 20s, but then succeeding in taking national power in 1949, you had a real socialist revolution in China in which the land was collectivized in large communes, where the land was worked in common and the produce of the land was shared in common. And in the factories, all of which were state-owned, you had a very high degree of education, health care, pensions, workers having some say in the running of the factories, etc. After Mao died in 1976, which brought to an end the Cultural Revolution, under Deng Xiaoping, forces that had opposed Mao increasingly over the years effectively carried out a coup d'etat, seized power, and began to introduce what increasingly became clear were capitalistic policies instead of socialist ones. It was a long process. There are many aspects to it. But one of them was that they dissolved the communes and gave the peasants instead individual household contracts to work the land. So each family now had to face the increasingly capitalistic market on their own. And the role of the peasants in controlling their own villages and all was reduced. And that set the background for the kind of struggles that we're seeing now. In the cities, they dissolved many of the state-owned industries, either semi-privatizing them in effect under manager and official control or selling them off outright, and tens of millions of workers lost their jobs. So there's been this whole pattern of increasing capitalist exploitation, corruption, often backed up by brutality on the part of the authorities, that's been building up now for three decades or more. And, you know, it's beginning to reach explosive character in some places. People just can't take it anymore. I mean, they're losing their land. They're losing the viability of their economic situations. And increasingly, they're just standing up against the system. And they're beginning to really raise anti-capitalist slogans and ideologies, looking back in part to the Mao era for ideas about, you know, alternatives, which means in the case of China, really some kind of socialist system again. So there's a lot of ferment. We don't hear much about it because it's only when you have a major incident like in Wuhan that it breaks into the Western media. But as I indicated, in fact, these conflicts are going on locally just all over the place on an increasingly constant basis.
That was Robert Weil, author of Red Cat, White Cat, China and the Contradictions of Market Socialism. Find links to news and analysis on growing social unrest in China by visiting our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.